Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Adria Breyer, a member of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and the chair of this program. I'm an international integrative cancer consultant, and it has been my mission for over 10 years with the support of Bill and the rest of the committee to bring forward science, important people in this field of conquering cancer, ideally with healthier approaches, to bring them forth to you. And our committee makes that part of its mission, so that you hear the information that's outside of the box instead of what we know, which is the download that basically you're not going to survive cancer, because we already know that's not necessarily the truth. Dr. Thomas Seyfried, it's taken a year because of his schedule to get this man here. I am excited beyond belief. I'm going to read you a little bit of his bio. Received his Ph.D. in genetics and biochemistry from the University of Illinois in Urbana in 76. Undergraduate work at the University of New England, formerly St. Francis College, and holds a master's degree in genetics from Illinois State University in Normal, Illinois. And we all know we're hearing a lot about genetics now, right? He was ahead of the curve back then. He served with distinction in the United States Army 1st Cavalry Division during the Vietnam War. I didn't know this. Thank you. And received medals and commendations, including the Bronze Star, Air Medal, and Army Commendations Medal. He was a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Neurology at Yale School of Medicine and served on faculty as an assistant professor in neurology. Prior to receiving full professorship, he was an associate professor in the Department of Biology at Boston College. He's received awards from the American Oil Chemist Society, the National Institute of Health, the American Society for Neuro... Does this ever end? The American Society for Neurochemistry, the Ketogenic Diet Special Interest Group of the American Epilepsy Society. His research program focuses on gene-environmental interactions related to complex diseases such as epilepsy, autism, brain cancer, and neurodegenerative diseases. Thank you for that as well. Dr. Seyfried investigates many of the diseases from the perspective of genetics, lipidomics, and energy metabolism, lipidomics. Much of his work also has a direct translational benefit to the clinic. A list of his recent publications appears on the website. I will tell you also that he has a book, and he and his publisher are giving a 30% discount on that book when you order it online. The code is CHEM5, and these flyers are out front. That's an extraordinary discount because the book is not inexpensive, but it is a Bible. Dr. Seyfried, it is my delight to be able to introduce you. Please come up and let your audience enjoy you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Adria. That was a very nice introduction. I appreciate that. And I'm really happy to be here this evening to speak to you all on the research that we're doing in the field of cancer and to share with you some of the developments that we have. Okay. My ears are still ringing a little bit, right? So I flew out, and it's not the ascent, it's the descent that seems to get you, which is like just a few hours ago. And it was kind of long to get into this place because the baseball team apparently had a game in the middle of the afternoon when they were... So it was the closed streets and things. Okay, here we go. All right, so as I said, I'm going to give you an overview of our view of cancer, and then I'm going to dive into details. Some of it's going to be some science, and at the end I'm going to show you how we've taken our preclinical work in the mouse and applied it to humans. Okay. But what I like to do always at the beginning of these kinds of presentations is a report card on how we're doing on this war on cancer. But we don't hear this on the TV ads that we get on Opdivo and Keytruda and how wonderful everybody is doing. But these are the data from the American Cancer Society. They come out every year with their new cases, information, deaths per year. And if we divide it by 365, we can get the number of people dying every day from cancer. And as you can see, and this is from the last 5 years, 2013 to 2017, the percentage of deaths is increasing faster than the percentages of new cases. Not good. Okay. As a matter of fact, the increase in the U.S. population was about 2.9%. So you put those things, those numbers into perspective. So what we're seeing here, then we have to ask ourselves, you know, what's going on? We hear a lot of hype about cancer. But these are the numbers. These are the sobering numbers associated with this disease. And we have people, so many people, running for cancer, swim for cancer, pink ribbons, this, that. What are we doing with all that money? Does anyone ever say, you know, I'm going to do research. Well, on what? Where is the money going? Okay, suppose every nickel of that money went into research. A lot of it doesn't. But we're not getting anything. There's nothing happening here. This is an abysmal situation. Look at the numbers. These are sobering numbers. I came back from China. They have 10,000 people a day dying from cancer in China. It's all over the world, all right? Something is seriously wrong. The more money we spend on cancer research, the more cancer we get. People better start asking, what's my dollar? Where is the accountability for the millions and millions of dollars that we're putting into this disease? It's incredible. So what's responsible for this? What's responsible for this is a fundamental misunderstanding about the nature of what this disease actually is. This is a simple cartoon from a cell, from a general biology book that we use. And the cell, I'm pointing out two organelles inside the cell, the nucleus and the mitochondrion. Okay, most of the field in cancer today is focused on abnormalities in the nucleus of the cell, the gene mutations and all this kind of stuff. But the mitochondrion in the cell and some of the other organelles are also defective in cancer cells. But the central focus over the years has been this nucleus and the mutations that are in the nucleus. And believe it, there are some cancers that have no mutations in the nucleus. Okay, so we have to ask ourselves, are we focused on the right organelle in the management of this disease? Because if we're not, we can explain why we have so many dead people and more coming. So this is a paper, Hallmarks of Cancer, the Next Generation, by Doug Hanahan and Robert Weinberg. Cancer is a genetic disease. The cancer cells carry the oncogenic and tumor suppressor genes that define cancer as a genetic disease. Okay? And as I say, the current dogma, and as I've said in many of my lectures, a dogma is an irrefutable truth. It's something that's no longer questioned. It's accepted by the practitioners of the field. It's like a religion. It's an orthodoxy. All right. We know this if you go into any textbook of biology or biochemistry or cell biology and you look at the cancer section, cancer is a genetic disease. You go to the NIH website, cancer is a genetic disease. There's no other discussion about this. This is the way it is. This is unquestionably what it is. Now, we have indoctrinated several generations of physicians and scientists into this dogmatic view. And we can see it on these. Here's a textbook in general biology, but this is pretty simplified. We're talking about the somatic mutation theory, which is the foundation upon which the gene theory is based. Mutations in genes that inhibit or stimulate cell division. Because the signature phenotype, what is cancer? Cancer is cell division out of control. That's the definition, cell division out of control. And they use this car that has accelerated as fast as it can go, and it has no brakes to represent oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes. All right, so this is the way they kind of convey the dogmatic view to the next generation. And then we look at more of these simplistic diagrams from textbook orientations and studies. Somatic accumulation of random mutation causes the development of a cancer cell. All right, so this is the cause, according to the dogmatic view. And you see mutation 1, mutation 2, 3, 4. Nobody knows. Nobody knows exactly how many mutations it would take. Sometimes it takes one, sometimes it takes two, sometimes it takes thousands. We don't really know. So you have the normal cell here, the normal cell, and eventually all these mutations cause this malignant cell, which is dysmorphic. This is called mesenchymal kind of phenotype. And it's really not known. And there are some cancer cells that have no mutations. So you have to figure that into the and nobody talks about that. All right, and then where we are today in this juggernaut of dogmatic view is personalized therapy. We hear it, precision medicine, personalized therapy. We hear it all the time. This is where we think we're going. Here's a woman staring into this screen, looking at abnormalities in a biopsy of a breast cancer, and she's going to make some sort of decision regarding possible therapy or prognosis or something along these lines. You know, there's a lot of issues here. Okay, what is she doing? She's trying to figure out what those spots and those mutations and changes mean. Listen, when you take a needle biopsy of a tumor, you disrupt the microenvironment of that. You disrupt the microenvironment. And you put that individual at risk. The process is called inflammatory oncotaxis. So what you're looking on that screen may not any longer be what's going on in that tissue. You have to be very careful about that, okay? People don't talk about that because we need to have this person looking at these mutations. Roche Holding, in the Wall Street Journal today, I read coming out on the plane, just purchased a company in Boston that looks at these mutations. Now, this would all be good if the mutations were, in fact, important. But I'm going to show you evidence that they're largely irrelevant. So we put patients at risk for a largely irrelevant activity that costs $7,200 to have the screens of the mutation, if you want the full screen. So let's look at the evidence that challenges this worldview. And when you ever challenge the dogmatic view of any dogma, I don't care what it is, religion, could be political, anything, this is the response you get. People don't want to hear it. They don't want to look at it. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to hear it. It's ignored, basically, because it's too unsettling. It's too unsettling. But let's look at the evidence. Okay, this was a study that was done by Dr. McKinnell and his group, published in a top journal, Science, of a very aggressive frog, kidney cancer in a frog. It's lethal. It kills these frogs. So what was done is on the bottom, a fertilized egg of another frog, the nucleus of that frog was removed, and a cell from the tumor was taken out, and the nucleus from the tumor cell containing the oncogenes and the tumor suppressor genes was now placed into that cytoplasm containing normal mitochondria. And what happened, there's the picture of the tadpole cloned from the nucleus of the tumor cell. And there was no cancer in the tadpole. The tadpole developed perfectly normal. The only problem is it didn't develop into a full frog. Some of the mutations or defects in that nucleus prevented the development, but it didn't cause any cancer. Findings are inconsistent with the somatic mutation theory of cancer. This is another more recent study that was done by Rudy Anish and his group at MIT. And Rudy is a very, very thorough, probably one of the best developmental biologists on the planet. And he had these malignant melanoma cells, and he characterized the mutations in the malignant melanoma cells. And then what he did was he transplanted the nucleus into an embryonic stem cell and cloned these mice from these malignant melanoma cells. And he said the presence of the major genetic abnormalities in the embryonic mice cloned from the tumor nuclei, unequivocal genomic evidence that the mice were cloned from a tumor nucleus, but they didn't have cancer. What's going on with that? If cancer is caused by nuclear gene mutations, one would have expected to see some sort of a dysregulated cell growth. And what happens? They abort and die. Just like the frog couldn't develop, these cells abort. Another study by Dr. Wang and her colleagues, Benny Kiripatu at Baylor College of Medicine, they did a different kind of an experiment. They took malignant metastatic cells, removed the mitochondria, and put new mitochondria from healthy cells and completely turned off the oncogene expressions and made these cells growth regulated. All right. This is inconsistent with the dogmatic view of what this disease is. Now, I published a paper. Not only in my book was the first chapter on that, chapter 11, but then I said, well, nobody's reading my book because it's too expensive. So I updated the article, and I published a more in-depth discussion of this. And this paper now is in Open Access Frontiers. And what I did was I took hundreds of these kinds of experiments, pulled them out of the literature from decades of research that everybody had ignored, and put them all together in a singular document so people can compare this experiment, that experiment. So when you ask people about this, they'll say, it can't be. But I encourage you, read the paper. Don't listen to what a third party will tell you about these things. People have their own mind. They can read the literature. They can make their own decision. And, you know, it's interesting. All these different kinds of studies were done on different tumor types, different mechanisms, different all kinds of different investigators. But the general conclusion came out the same. It doesn't support the somatic mutation theory of cancer. So what I and my students did was we draw this little cartoon to summarize all these dozens of experiments. You know, it's very one thing. It's very interesting. We have a crisis in cancer science today. Half the stuff that people do can't be reproduced. This is a serious embarrassment to the field. How is it possible that all these guys could basically reproduce their finding? There must be something wrong with that, right? So, and this is what makes it very interesting. And they weren't testing the gene theory of cancer. They were just asking what role do cancer cells have in development. But when you can take those same data and put it in and see whether or not it fits the dogmatic view. So the green cell is the normal cell. Green cells beget normal cells beget normal cells. They have a normal nucleus, integrated genetic activity. They have a normal mitochondria producing energy normally. The red cells are the tumor cells, and we know tumor cells beget tumor cells. Each tumor cell makes more tumor cells. They grow and grow. What's responsible for that organ, that phenotype? Is it the gene mutations in the nucleus, like the dogma says, or is it the defect in the mitochondria, which is the real origin of the disease? Okay? Because they're both abnormal. So you take the red nucleus and put it into the green cell, and you get green cells and green and tissue and sometimes an organism without cancer, despite the fact that it has the nucleus containing the so-called mutations that are supposed to be the cause of the disease. Inconsistent. And if you take the green nucleus from a normal cell and put it into the cytoplasm of a tumor cell like Schaefer and Israel did, you get either dead cells or tumor cells. You do not get normal cells. Completely inconsistent. These are the strongest evidence to date to say that cancer cannot be a nuclear-driven disease. Now, what does that mean? You hear it all the time. All cancer. This undermines the entire cancer industry with respect to what they're focusing on. Consequently, we have 1,600 people a day dying from the disease. That's the consequences of not understanding the biology of the very disease that you're working on. Those are the consequences. Now, if cancer is not a genetic disease, then where does it come from? If the somatic theory, you just told you, the somatic mutation theory, which is the bedrock for the gene theory, is wrong. It's not consistent with the evidence. And I'm just showing you some of the evidence. So you can, if you look at all of the evidence, you'd be shocked. And then you'd say, how is it possible that we can have so many so-called smart people doing this stuff when they're completely off base? Right? So Otto Warburg, years ago, the German, the most noted scientist in the 20th century, had claimed that cancer arises from damage to respiration. Energy through fermentation compensates for the respiration, and you get these cells now that start to ferment instead of respire. And that's the signature defect that underlies all these cancer cells. And they talk about the Warburg effect, which is confused to most people. They don't really understand. And we now have evidence that cancer cells not only ferment lactic acid from glucose, but they also ferment succinic acid from glutamine. So that was the missing link in Warburg's theory, and now we have a paper that's going to come out and describe all that. That's going to settle a lot of things. So let me ask you this. You saw the woman staring at the screen looking for all the mutations, right? If you take a tumor and you look at every cell in that tumor, every cell in that tumor will have a different profile of cancer mutations, so-called mutations. This cell is different from that cell. You take another tumor, he has different. Everyone is different. But every cell in that tumor is fermenting. They're all fermenting, and I'll talk about that. They get energy from non-oxidative processes. If every cell in the tumor is fermenting, doesn't it make sense to target the common pathophysiological problem that's in the cells rather than going after all these esoteric things that are downstream? So this is the question we have to, and I'm going to show you the evidence of how we manage cancer targeting the common pathophysiological problem, not all this downstream epiphenomena. So When we look at energy metabolism, again, this is very simplistic. I'm not getting into details of the pathways. This is very simplistic. We are sitting here. I am speaking to you. You are listening to me, and we're all breathing, I think. Any zombies out here? Okay. So we breathe air in. We get energy. So the big ATP coming from oxidative phosphorylation, 89 to 90% of the energy in our body to let our brain work and all our organs work, is coming from us breathing air. We use oxygen as a final acceptor. And if you notice, we get a little bit of energy from these ancient pathways, substrate level phosphorylation, in the cytoplasm and in the Krebs cycle, inside the mitochondria. Okay, so this is how all of our normal cells are functioning right now. We're getting energy by breathing, and we're getting this. Now, you look at a cancer cell, and you have the very big shift. You get very little energy from oxidative phosphorylation, and you get significantly more energy from substrate level. These are ancient pathways that existed before oxygen came into the atmosphere. All right, so the cancer cells are essentially getting energy from an alternative source, and that's driven by glucose and glutamine. Those are the fuels. A sugar and an amino acid are the drivers of this fermentation metabolism inside the tumor cell. So then we say, okay, we put it all together. But don't forget, we've had thousands and millions of dollars on cancer research collecting millions of different facts and observations. You can't just ignore all the facts. You have to reconfigure the facts in light of the alternative view of where the disease comes from. So in this particular diagram that my students put together in my cancer class over several years, reorganizes the hallmarks of cancer in light of the mitochondrial metabolic origin of the disease. The mitochondria are the origin. So people always ask me, how do we get cancer? And I say, well, if you're exposed to carcinogens, you might get cancer. If you get radiated, you could get cancer. If you have hypoxia, hypoxia in various tissues, inflammation in the body can cause cancer. Rare inherited mutations like BRCA1 and this kind of thing can cause cancer. Hepatitis virus, papillomavirus, you can get cancer from viruses. And the older you get, you can get cancer. The cancer comes when you get older. All right? So that was called the oncogenic paradox. And the oncogenic paradox was no one could figure out how all these disparate different things could cause cancer in a common pathophysiological mechanism. And if those of you who have read The Emperor of All Maladies by Sid Mukherjee, which was on the bestseller list, Pulitzer Prize, right? He was struggling with this. Go to page 285 or 303. We can't figure out what the common pathophysiological mechanism is damage to the respiration of the cell. That's the link. That's the link to bring the oncogenic paradox and link all the hallmarks to that. What happens is the mitochondria throughout these reactive oxygen species, ROS. ROS are carcinogenic and mutagenic. They cause the mutations that you see in the nucleus. They're an effect of the damage to the respiration. Okay? And then when that organelle becomes damaged, it signals the nucleus. It says, we're suffocating. The cell is beginning to suffocate. How are we going to stay alive? And oncogenes turn on. Oncogenes are transcription factors that upregulate the pathways so the cell can ferment. That's what Warburg was saying. The cell is shifting from breathing air to fermenting. All right? And then you have this signaling, and you can see the green line goes down. That's the oxidative phosphorylation. And the red line goes up. That's these ancient fermentation pathways, and the cell now goes into this new metabolic state of dysregulated cell growth, and we can put the hallmarks, now we can look at the Hanahan hallmarks and link them all, because the first three hallmarks, self-sufficiency, insensitivity, and limitless replicative potential, all of that comes from the damage to the respiration, and the cells fall back on their default state. Okay, the default state is what they do when they're no longer restricted. And every cell on the planet before oxygen came into the atmosphere was proliferating, unbridled proliferation, and they would die when you took away when the fermentation fuels in the microenvironment disappeared, the cells would die. So these cancer cells are doing nothing more than falling back on these ancient pathways that existed before oxygen came into the environment. And then you say, well, that's driving it. Okay, what is the fuel that's driving it? And then you say, well, what were the fuels back in the old days that were driving these things? All right, amino acids and some carbs and things like this, and then they would collapse. So the first three, and then you have a cancer that looks like a wound, so that releases lactic acid, and then angiogenesis, the blood vessels come in. This is all explainable. And then, avoiding when you're sick, the cell is supposed to die. It goes through a programmed cell death. Oh, this cell's sick. Okay, what controls that? The mitochondria control the programmed cell death. The mitochondria are the kill switch. The kill switch is now broken, and the cell now doesn't die under apoptosis. So it bypasses all this because the very organelle responsible is now defective. So the key thing then, which then you have to say, well, how does metastasis come? Metastasis, of course, is what most people fear, and is what makes it much the most difficult to manage, is the spread of the cancer cell through the body. And of course, according to the gene theory, it's the EMT, epithelial mesenchymal transition, and I don't want to spend my time on that nonsense. But so I'm going to give you the way it really happens. So here you have these blue cells, epithelial cells. They're all organized. They have a basement membrane. They're linked together with adhesion molecules. Then they get dysmorphic from any one of the provocative in the environment. Like I said, any one of the oncogenic paradox could cause these cells. But they can't metastasize. They're not programmed to spread through your body. But our immune system sees this group of cells, and it comes in and says, their job is to heal wounds. These cells are behaving like an unhealed wound, and these red cells are part of our immune system, and they come in and they throw out growth factors and cytokines in an attempt to heal the wound. The problem is those incipient cancer cells are using that to fire. It's like throwing gasoline on the fire. They grow even faster. Our immune cells are designed to fuse with other cells to facilitate wound healing. And what happens is these red cells, which have the capacity to move in and out of the bloodstream, spread throughout the body, avoid them, they are part of the immune system. Our immune system becomes the metastatic cell. And now what we have is this fusion. So the damaged mitochondria in these blue cells, which can't metastasize, dilutes the normal mitochondria in the macrophage, and now we have rogue macrophages. And Dr. Heisentreit, sitting here, was one of the key people that made these connections to this metastatic spread of cancer. These cells are genetically programmed to enter and exit. They do all the things that metastatic cells do. So the metastatic cell is part of our immune system, one of the toughest cells in our body. They live in hypoxic environments. Consequently, the billions of dollars we spent on angiogenesis drugs don't work because they'll take the blood vessels away. Sure, they grow a little slower, but you don't kill them because they live in hypoxic environments. The angiogenesis doesn't work. Right? It doesn't work because the cell you're trying to kill doesn't care about that. It can live without blood vessels. Okay, so fermentation, you know, how do we target this? Well, one strategy, here, calorie restriction, ketogenic diets. What do? They lower blood sugar and they raise ketone bodies, and ketone bodies are a non-fermentable fuel. Cancer cells can't use the ketone body. All the normal cells in our body can use them. The cancer cells cannot use the ketone bodies because you need a good mitochondria, and I just showed, and I'll show you more evidence that you can't do that. Now, of course, it really makes normal cells very, very healthy. And also water-only fasting. That's if you really want to pound these cancer cells really big, stop eating, just drink water. People say, well, you got to be nuts to do that. But I have people from all over the world telling me how long they fasted to get rid of their cancer. It takes 20, 30, sometimes 40 days. It's too hard for most people. So we try to do it with the metabolic therapy. It makes it a little bit easier. So then we say, you know, what are these ketogenic diets worked in the epilepsy field for years? We built these diets. We treated thousands and thousands of children with epilepsy on these ketogenic diets. And the key thing in the ketogenic diet to stop seizures, you got to keep that blood sugar low. And to kill cancer cells, you got to keep that blood sugar low. The cancer cells need the sugar. They can't use the ketones. So it's a very low fat, very, very low carbohydrate, high fat, moderate protein. It delivers a lot of energy. And as I say, it must be always consumed in restricted amounts. Nobody goes out and pounds massive amounts of fat. And the people who do don't get protected from cancer, nor do they get protected from epilepsy. The ketogenic diet is a medicine. It shouldn't be viewed as a Mediterranean diet, an Atkins diet, or any of these kinds of. It's a medicine. People need to know how to use it like any medicine. And this is a very simple thing here. You want to manage your cancer, you got to lower the blood sugar. Okay? You got to raise the ketone bodies. And I'm only going to tell, this is the first part, because we have to talk about the amino acid too. But the first step is you got to slow down the beast. He needs the glucose. You got to start targeting it and restricting it. And there's ways I'm going to show you how we can pound this down really far, because we can transition the whole body over to ketones. Now, a lot of people over the years have come to me and said, oh, my blood sugar is all over the place. I can't control it. And I'd say, what about your ketones? Well, they seem to be okay, but but, you know, my blood sugar and this and that. So my students and I sat together and we said, hey, we can't measure glucose and ketones independently. We have to have some sort of a technique where we can make a ratio of this. So we published this paper, the Glucose Ketone Index Calculator, a very simple tool to help people with brain cancer. It helps people with every kind of cancer. It turns out now more people who don't have any cancer want to get into the therapeutic ketosis using our thing here. It wasn't designed for healthy people, but healthy people can stay even healthier if they do this. Okay. They made an app over here in Silicon Valley called Heads Up Health uses this thing from us. So what is the ratio of blood sugar to blood ketones? Blood sugar, you take a meter like the diabetics have, and you get a little drop of blood. And you write it down, and then you take the other strip, the ketone strip, and you take the same drop of blood, and you can get the blood sugar and blood ketone numbers from the same meter using two different strips. And then we push the button, bang, comes the singular number. People, I mean, it's very simple division. But some people, I don't want to do that. Okay, we just push the button, you get the number. And the idea is if you can get the number to 1.0 or below, now you're in therapeutic ketosis, and the tumor cells are being restricted in their ability to grow fast. And you will kill a lot of tumor cells, but you won't kill them all. But you can do a pretty good job on them. The first, one of the major studies that was done on ketogenic diets for cancer was done by Linda Nebling and her colleagues at the Case Western Reserve in Cleveland. And she took two hopeless cases. And as I said, if you ever read the original PhD dissertation that Linda did on these kids, it breaks your heart what they did to these two little kids. Radiated, surgically mutilated them, poisoned them with initial life. They were both hopeless. She was able to get them and say, let's try this metabolic keto thing here. And they said, okay. And both kids had a remarkable improvement, quality of life. They lived far longer than they were supposed to. They did really well. Nobody ever followed this up. We don't use this in any clinic, as far as I know, for children. It's a tragedy.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So I looked at those data, and I said, whoa, let's consider what we're doing. Why don't we have preclinical models of brain cancer? Why don't we test it on our brain cancer models? And this is a CT2A astrocytoma. It's a neural stem cell tumor that you see in glioblastoma. So standard high carbohydrate diet, UR is unrestricted. Let the mouse eat as much high carb as he wants. Look at the size of that tumor on his head, right? Huge. Same diet, restricted by 40%, caused a 65 to an 85% reduction in the size of the tumor just by restricting the calories. So I said, what's going on here? What's going on? So then we did linear regression analysis. These are linear regressions using glucose as the independent variable. Each square is a mouse under a different dietary condition. And what you see on this is as the blood glucose goes down, the ketones go up. That's an evolutionarily conserved adaptation to food restriction. That's what happens. We start mobilizing energy out of our fat. The fat is brought to the liver. The liver makes ketone bodies, and healthy cells start burning this. Look at the other side. As blood sugar goes down, the weight of the tumor goes down. The higher the sugar, the faster the tumor grows. The lower the sugar, the slower the tumor grows. The higher the sugar, the faster the tumor grows. The lower the sugar, the slower the tumor grows. Right? This has been now documented in all kinds of human cancers. But people in the oncology clinics don't seem to know this. You ever see the kids eat the big ice cream cakes and come in and this? Give the cancer guy Infamil. What are you, crazy? This is documented. People don't read the literature. You don't give cancer patients high sugar things unless you want their tumor to grow fast. It's unbelievable. And then we define the mechanisms by which this works. It's anti-angiogenic, blocks blood vessels. It reduces the angry and inflammation in the tumor microenvironment. It kills tumor cells. I mean, it's unbelievable. And I throw this in because a woman read our stuff who had a dog with a big tumor on his face, on his nose, right under the nostril. And the woman said that the vet wanted to surgically remove the tumor, give the dog radiation and chemo. And she said no. And she took our metabolic therapy and gave the dog a raw meat ketogenic diet. You can see the tumor, little spot. Now it's gone. Now this dog is still alive today, right? No chemo, nothing. And there's a YouTube video that I did on this from one of my other lectures. Got 5.3 million hits. Can you believe this? So Anyway, a lot of people now are feeding the dog raw meat. And the veterinary clinic said, oh, you can't do that. And because they're afraid salmonella put. What are you giving the dog, some rotten thing off the floor? You know, it's not going to get salmonella. You give good organic meat and the dog is going to do fine. He's not going to get salmonella. You know, people worry about these things. So anyway, I want to talk now about human stuff a little bit more and then some more mouth stuff. And this is what we work on, glioblastoma multiforme. We work on all kinds of cancer. They're all the same. All the cancers are exactly the same. You don't have to worry about anything. They're all the same. The same treatment that works on GBM will work on breast and will work on colon, work on bladder. Anyway, GBM is bad. You know, we have Senator John McCain now suffering from this this condition. And, you know, it's a pretty tough disease. It grows pretty rapidly. It's got a very large number of different kinds of cells that are all neoplastic. You know, when you look at the section of the brain from somebody who passed away from this, you see this ugly stain with a big cyst in the middle of the brain. You see it should be a nice demarcation between the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere. You get this midline shift. The tumor forces the midline. Most of these poor people die from intracranial pressure. Okay, the tumor just continues to swell and they die from this. You'll notice this was probably irradiated and all kinds of things, which causes radiation causes fusion hybridization. So I'll talk more about that. These darker cells are the tumor cells moving around the blood vessel. So the interesting thing is these tumor cells, even though you can't see them on the normal part of the brain, they're all through. They've seeded through the whole brain. Okay, they run across the surface of the blood vessels and the Virchow Robin space, and they just spread through your whole brain. So you can't pluck it out with you can't get it out with surgery. Surgery is only a temporary thing. So we look at this is an electron micrograph of the mitochondria in these glioblastoma, and the one here on the left is the stripes. They contain the structures that allow the organelle to breathe. All the lipids and proteins are of the electron transport chain are in those stripes. They're called cristae. And the one on the right, GBM, glioblastoma mitochondria, a large matrix. You don't see the stripes. So if the very structure of the organelle is not there to respire, there's no way in hell that organelle, that cell is going to be able to get energy from respiration. So in order for that cell to be alive, it has to ferment. And we know GBM cells are powerful fermenters. So here's the structural evidence. Structure dictates function. There's so many people saying there's nothing wrong with the mitochondria and glioblastoma. Well, are they blind? This is what you have to deal with. Now, we know the two fuels that drive the beast are glucose and glutamine. And these are the two fuels that will generate nothing works without ATP. Nothing in our body works without ATP. You've got to have energy, all right? Where is the energy coming from? It's coming from the fermentation of glucose and glutamine. And they're getting a tremendous amount of energy out of the TCA cycle in the form of substrate-level phosphorylation. And those two fuels will build all the fats, all the nucleotides, all the amino acids, and protect those cells against radiation damage because they're powerfully antioxidant inside the cell. So those two fuels are protecting and allowing those cells to grow. So what's the best way to kill the cancer cell? You have to take away the fuels that are driving the fermentation, and I'll show you this. Cancer is an extremely simple disease. It's fueled by two molecules, glucose and glutamine. There's not enough of anything else to drive the beast. All right, we looked into this. Now, what do we do in the clinic when somebody comes in and is diagnosed with a glioblastoma? Well, first thing, most people are so stunned and shocked by the fact of the diagnosis, they're in a state of shock. The family is in a state of shock. Everybody's in a state of shock. What is GBM? Well, look it up. Oh, my God. It's like the death sentence. It doesn't have to be that way, but it is. So what do we do? The first thing, before the poor person knows what's going on, we have him in the operating room taking the tumor out of his head. Now, sometimes that's necessary if he has a problem with herniation of the brain, yes. But there's a lot of times you have a watchful waiting period. You don't have to do it right away. That's where the metabolic stuff will come in, and I'll talk to you about that. So what we do is we surgically debulk the tumor, creating an even more aggressive wound, bringing in all kinds of immune cells into this environment. Then we irradiate the poor person, causing fusion hybridization and breaking up and freeing up massive amounts of glutamine by breaking the glutamine-glutamine cycle inside that tumor, feeding the beast with the very fuels that it needs. Now, many of these poor people, their brain starts to swell from the radiation. Okay, so how do you stop the swelling? You give them high-dose dexamethasone, a steroid. The high-dose dexamethasone also causes hyperglycemia, right? So the very thing we're doing to the patient to manage his disease is creating a worst-case situation. Many of these tumor cells are infected with human cytomegalovirus, which now facilitates like a supercharger using glucose and glutamine. So the very things that we're doing to these people is going to contribute to the rapid recurrence of the tumor and the death of that individual. Now, where are the data to support what I just said? They're here, over and over again, published throughout the world literature on this. The paper from Stoop is one of the more the classic paper to sell how we're going to treat patients with GBM. If you look at the red line, there was no survivors of the 278 zero. Right? What would you expect? I just explained to you what's going to happen. And if you throw in a little temozolomide, you get a few extra people that were... That's the single biggest advance in brain cancer research in 50 years, putting in temozolomide. What's temozolomide? It's a toxic alkylating agent. Well, how is temozolomide... Okay, and the other thing, right over here in UCSF, they found out that temozolomide increases driver mutations. This guy Johnson and his group over here. Well, what is driver? That makes supposed to make the tumor worse, yet the people getting temozolomide have a little bit better progression-free survival. So we looked up, what is temozolomide? Nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, fatigue, all indirect forms of calorie restriction. You got to be, you say to yourself, what are we doing? What the hell are we doing to these poor people? Give me a break. Now, here's a tragic example. Here's Brittany Maynard. Do you remember Brittany? She's from here. She was from around this area. She went in 2014 with a low grade. They found a low grade. They went in and tried to take the low grade. Within 1 month, it becomes a glioblastoma multiforme. This is a picture of her with her husband. Then she said, and then look at her face here. This is moon face from overdose steroids. High dose steroids create moon face. So we know. She says, I'm out of here. She goes north here. I guess in Oregon, they have a death with dignity rule that you can go up there and take your own life. Right? So she throws the towel in on November 1st, 2014, and she publicized this in People magazine, saying that I'm not going to deal with this. What kind of a statement is that on the profession? If you're working in this profession and your patients are going to take death with dignity, what does it say about what you're doing?
Not much.
So, and here's another example. This is Pablo Kelly. He contacted me. He was diagnosed in the same year as Brittany, August 2014. He heard some of my YouTube videos. He looked at the data. And he says, I have a GBM. I'm not doing radiation, chemo. I'm not doing anything. He said, I'm not doing surgery. I'm not doing anything. So what Pablo did is he went on the metabolic therapy. He has a YouTube video. He said to me, I want to live. I said, okay. Well, I didn't hear from him. You know, I thought he was dead. So, because they told him he only had 3 to 6 months at the max if you didn't take the standard of care, like what Brittany did. You're going to... So about a year and a half go by, and I get an email from Pablo, and he says, I think I might have surgery now because the metabolic therapy made my inoperable brain tumor operable. I said, oh, that's good news, right? So about a year and a half later. So 2 years later it was. So last year he had the tumor operated, no radiation, no chemo. He has a little bit of seizures now, but everything is under control. And I just emailed with him earlier this month. His wife is ready to have a baby any day. He's doing really well. I'm giving a big lecture in London to the Childhood Cancer Center, and Pablo is going to give a talk after me. There's nothing like having the guy sitting right there. He can tell you all you want to know, right? So this is really remarkable. So in order for us to make the kind of advances in cancer that you need to make to help people, you've got to have the preclinical models that are the best and really replicate exactly what goes on in the mouse. And Dr. Heisentreit was one of the key people who developed these models for us, the VM models. They arise spontaneously in the brain, and they have all the growth characteristics that you see in human glioblastoma. And we genetically engineered these cells to be bioluminescent so we can actually follow the cells migrating through the brain, invading through the brain. And if we have a therapy, we can get rid of the light and we can kill them. And we can really do some really interesting things because these are the real McCoy. These are, most of the models that the industry uses are artificial xenografts and all these nonsense. You're taking human cells and putting them into a mouse's body. Give me a break. 50 million years of evolution separate these patients. All right, they work. I mean, they're okay for things, but they're not the real. You're not going to get the real information. People always say, oh, you can cure cancer in a mouse. Not if you have the same kind of cancer that we have, and the mouse has the same. It's very hard to cure his cancer, just like it's hard to cure ours. But those artificial models, they always look good on the Science and Nature papers. Now, what we did is we threw the kitchen sink at this tumor. So the brain tumor there, hippocampus, we really lowered blood sugar. We give them ketogenic diets. And what we did is we stopped the invasion, but we weren't able, and we killed some of them, but we weren't able to eradicate the tumor. So I said, what are these guys using? What are they using to stay alive? We threw everything at them. Humans respond much better to ketogenic diets than the mouse does, I'll tell you that. So we decided, say, it's got to be glutamine. It's the only other fuel available in sufficient quantity to drive the beast. So to test the glutamine hypothesis, we used this drug, 6-diazo-5-oxo-L-neuron, we call it DON. It binds up the ability of the cell to use glutamine. And it also, so you really stop DNA synthesis and you stop ATP in the TCA cycle. So here's the way we design our experiments. So we put the cells into the mouse's brain. We wait a few days so the tumor is raging, and then we start the metabolic diet. So you give them either a high-carb diet, unrestricted, like I showed you, or the ketogenic diet, restricted, after a little bit of a fast. And then we pulsed with DON, bing, every couple of days, bing, bing. So we have the diet on one side holding down the glucose, the drug is targeting the glutamine, and the guys eating the high-carbohydrate diet that don't get any drugs start dying at 15, so we stop the whole experiment at day 15, and we evaluate the brain using bioluminescence. And this is a bioluminescence image, and you can see bright light, blue, yellow, and red in the standard high-carb diet on the top. The ketogenic diet, yes, there's still some light there. As I said, we weren't able to kill these tumor cells using ketogenic diet by itself. But we stopped invasion, but we weren't able to kill them. But then when you combine the glutamine inhibitor with the ketogenic diet, we got no light, okay? And we really looked at these things. What's going on? We did a lot of mice. I'm just showing you a few of them here. We did many, many mice. No light. Are we sure? So I said to my Pernah Mukherjee, my associate, look at the histology. What's going on inside the brains of these guys? So here's the brain. And what we have here is the high-carbohydrate dyes are on the far left over here. You can see the dark, dense tumor cells, and the whiter area is the normal, and those tumor cells are ripping through into the normal part of the brain, just like human GBM. So they're invading like crazy, and if you look at the high power below, they're densely packed, many mitotic figures. They're living, they're thriving. Ketogenic diet. You can see the demarcation is much sharper. It's stopping the invasion, just like I said. You see the white and the blue part are separated more cleanly. That's the diet, all right? And also, the cells are not as densely packed. Very interesting. But when we put the diet with the drug, glutamine and glucose, this is a slaughter. This is massive killing of the tumor cells by combining the glucose inhibitor, by the diet with the glutamine inhibitor. We slaughter these tumor cells, and we kill them by mitotic catastrophe, necrotic death. We just blasted them out of existence. And now we're perfecting this, and we're treating patients. I'm going to show you some data from humans. Now, based on all the stuff that we did in the mouse, we then built the press pulse therapeutic strategy for the metabolic management of all cancer, not just brain cancer. So what we do, and this goes back to paleobiology, apparently on our planet, there was massive extinction of organisms over the eons. It only happened when you had two unlikely events, a chronic stress from climate or whatever on a population, and then some unlikely volcanic or meteor strike, and all of a sudden everything is gone. Everything is dead. So we decided to take this concept to kill cancer cells. So we use ketogenic diets, ketone supplementation as press, and we use stress management, exercise, massage therapies, and you'd be surprised. So many cancer patients have anxiety. They have anxiety because they think they have a terminal disease or something that's going to kill them, and therefore they get anxiety. So we get rid of anxiety. We put them on these diets, bring them back into a more stabilized, balance the exercise, and then we hit them with these pulses. And we use glucose inhibitors like insulin, and we have some others that will force the blood sugars way down. As long as the patient is in therapeutic ketosis, you can push blood sugars down to unmeasurable levels. And then we hit them with the glutamine inhibitor, bang, bang. And then we use hyperbaric oxygen as an alternative to radiation therapy, because hyperbaric oxygen will kill cancer cells just like radiation, as long as you can remove the antioxidant capacity inside the cell, which is driven by glucose and glutamine. So you get rid of the glucose and glutamine. Now the cells will be killed by hyperbaric oxygen. You don't need radiation. And we bring the patient into a managed state, the yellow, and we keep going until we get resolution. And when these people emerge from this therapy, you can't believe, many of these guys are obese, they have all kinds of metabolic imbalances and all kinds of things. You get rid of all that along with the cancer. My authors here, Joe Maroon, George Yu, Dom DiAgostino, a couple of physician scientists. So, now I'm going to share with you, this is our patient that we just published recently out of Egypt. Guy, a young man, 38 years old, a corn farmer, come into the clinic. He had a whole left with power. He couldn't walk. His arm and leg were drooping. He had elevated triglycerides. His vitamin D levels were all screwed up. And he had a glioblastoma. So rather than jump him with a we put him on a three-day water-only fasting. This was followed then by a 900 kilocalorie a day, three weeks of ketogenic diet. Then he did an awake craniotomy where the tumor was debulked after 3 weeks of already the microenvironment of the tumor had been recognized to be different than other cases. And then after we did the bulking, we put him on chloroquine, EGCG, hyperbaric oxygen. EGCG is the green tea extract. And we did that for 3 months. And then he went under radiation and chemo. You can't get out of this radiation. Everybody, you can't leave that clinic until somebody radiates your ass. So the poor guy had to have radiation and he had the chemo, but it was done 3 months later. And he went through that pretty well. And now he was out 20. He went back. He's working back in the fields. He seems to be doing okay. At least he never took steroids. And if you look at the data from him, we brought his GKI, glucose ketone index, way down. And then you can see the tumor at the beginning before we did the operation, how big it was. And you can see the midline shift. Just like I told you, these tumors grow. They cause intracranial pressure. They lead to certain nerve paralysis. And as you can see the metabolic therapy, you'll see the red squiggle gets straighter and straighter and straighter. So we corrected the midline shift. And we shrunk the tumor down. The quality of life of this guy is great. He's back working in the cornfield. I don't know how long he's going to live, but he's certainly doing all right. Now, we have this person. Now, we have a big clinic in Turkey, in Istanbul, Turkey. And my colleagues there are treating with our metabolic therapy, pressed pulse, many different cancers. This is a woman with triple negative breast cancer. And you can see the number one points to the PET scan on her breast, and then 2 points to the liver, metastasis to the liver, and 3 is metastasis into smooth muscle. So here we did hypothermia, hyperbaric oxygen, ketogenic diets, and the lowest of the low, chemo. Again, you can't get out of these clinics unless somebody poisons your ass. So they used the lowest dose possible, and I asked them, what would happen if we used none? He said they'd do better. They're locked in to do this. So here's the patient. She's doing remarkably well. No hair loss. Quality of life is very good. So I don't know how long these people are going to live, but they're doing a hell of a lot better than they would have if they were treated with standards of care for the most part. Not everybody using this lives. And these guys are only doing stage 4. And they've got pancreatic. They've got metastatic lung. They've got all kinds of cancers over there that would be considered terminal. I don't like to use the word terminal anymore because I don't think cancer is a terminal disease. Anybody's, I have a terminal cancer. No, you don't. You must be at the wrong clinic. So we look back and we see the difference between standard of care and keto metabolic therapy. And we have to say, how many tragic cases do we have like Brittany and many others that are going through this? And how many more could be better like Pablo? And you have to say to yourself, you know, what the hell is going on here? Give me a break. So when I conclude, I say cancer is a mitochondrial metabolite. It's not a genetic disease. This misunderstanding is the single greatest tragedy in the history of medicine. More people are suffering and dying because they don't know what the disease is. It's a mitochondrial metabolic disease. They rely on substrate level phosphorylation. You restrict glucose and glutamine and you get a handle on this disease. And you can do it without harming the rest of the body. Depressed pulse metabolic therapy is a non-toxic, cost-effective strategy for the management and possible resolution of all types of cancer. And I think at some point, this approach will make all other approaches obsolete. Unless people want to live. Right? So I have many acknowledgments. I thank all the people that work with me from all the different countries all over the world. I was over in China. They want to get onto this. And basically, I want to thank the people who support our research. Travis Christofferson's Foundation, Metabolic Cancer Therapies. Joe Mercola, George Yu Foundation. The CrossFit Group is now very interested in what we do. Dr. Joe Maroon, neurosurgeon at University of Pennsylvania, at Pittsburgh, also team surgeon for the Pittsburgh Football Steelers. Ellen Davis, my own university, and in the past, the NIH. Thank you for your attention.
And I remember listening to an interview of you and saying, yes. Would you please explain that to the audience? People think they can't have alcohol at all.
No, that's not true. We did some studies where we took people, my own students, as a matter of fact, and we put them in ketosis, and then we gave them various kinds of alcohol to see if they would be thrown out of ketosis. If you drink dark red wine, it doesn't throw you out of ketosis. White wines, some of the driest white wines will not throw you out of ketosis. So it depends on the sugar content in the wine itself. All right, some are very dry. Very expensive dry champagne does not throw you out of ketosis. One person told me a small amount of scotch. Bourbon does throw you out of ketosis. There's too much sugar in bourbon. Vodka, I don't know. I haven't tested that. But I think it's not necessary that one has to abstain from alcohol completely while in therapeutic. Whatever throws you out. And people say, well, how much can I drink?
Right.
And the answer is measure your GKI. You got the tool in your hand. Okay, drink one glass of wine and measure your GKI. Oh, it looks good. Drink another glass of wine and see what it does. If it's three or four glasses of wine, you probably won't know what strip to put into the meter anymore. You won't worry about it.
And where do people get that meter?
Oh, it's now they have Keto Mojo, Precision Extra. We're testing them all now against biochemical analysis in the lab. So it's a way to do this. The best is biochemical analysis, but nobody can do that. So these meters are the best. So Precision Extra made by Abbott, and now the Keto Mojo, it's another company that's coming out with a glucose ketone monitor. Because a lot of people that want to stay fit and buff and all that, they're all into this, so they're all with the meters. But it was made for cancer patients. It wasn't made for young people who want to stay super fit. You know, these supreme athletes and things.
So basically online, they can get these online?
Oh, yeah. You can buy them. You can get it all on Amazon. Amazon sells everything.
How do people qualify to get into your clinic? What's the procedure?
I don't have a clinic. Okay? I don't have three patients. My friends do.
Okay.
They have to fly to Istanbul, Turkey. Right? They have to wear. Isn't it terrible? Why can't you go over UCSF over? This is supposed to be a great, right? They can't treat patients using keto metabolic therapy. They'll lose their license.
You are talking to the choir.
Yeah.
But let's tell them, give us a little more information on what path people would follow to even, is Istanbul the only place?
More are coming. The thing you want to do is if you're diagnosed with cancer at the beginning, the first thing you want to do is you want to do metabolic therapy. That's, and bring the tumor. Because a lot of this could be eliminated before you have to do anything else. You know, why poke somebody to take punch biopsy? I mean, I would never get poked by anything. So, because it's going to flare up. It increases your risk. What? So some guy can look at a screen and make worthless information?
Right.
Give me a break. So, so you got to know what to do. You want to shrink, you know, if you can possibly do it. The problem is, I feel bad for the cancer patients because when they go to the so-called professionals, they don't know anything about this. And if they do, they call it quackery. What's more quackery than doing what I just showed you? The standard of care is quackery. You got people that don't know what the disease is treating people that have the disease. Can you believe this?
Totally.
1,600 people a day are dying. Why is that?
How do people eliminate glutamine from their diets?
Not, you can't
food?
Do it by diet.
Okay, so how do you eliminate
the You got to use drugs. Okay.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because glutamine is the most abundant amino acid in the body. It's in the tissues. It plays such a valuable role in our immune system. So you have to use drugs. And the drugs have to be done very strategically. This is the concept of the press pulse. The pulse has to be done strategically. This is not incidental. It's not like we have to invent anything new. It's just that we have to trial and error to determine, because we don't want to harm anybody. There should be no reason why anybody with cancer should have any discomfort or any harm, ever. Okay, so in order to do that, you have to use the right situation. Patients brought into therapeutic ketosis first, get all the measurements. Then we pulse with a little bit of DON. We can't get DON. It's just we can get it experimentally. I haven't tested the group from China. The Chinese are making it over there. And then the other thing we have to worry about, which is despicable and immoral, is that when you find a drug that was sitting around that had very little recognition or function, and then you realize that it's has a cancer value, they jack the price up by thousands of percent, right? Is that immoral or not immoral? They did that Lumistine. They did that. Who are the people that would do something like that? Where are these despicable scoundrels that would do something like that and treat someone's unfortunate situation with a disease, and you have to raise the price so you can make a buck on his sick? This is sick. This is sickness. But yet it happens, and no one says anything about it. Who's saying anything about it? We call it Scarelli'd. They take these drugs. Remember that guy, Martin Scarelli, the guy with the EpiPen? The pharmaceutical companies do the same thing. They Scarelli the drugs. It's despicable. But yet, hey, they all go. They all do this.
Well, frankly, I'm glad you're still alive. We have questions about that as well. Not about your being alive, but you know what I'm talking about.
Is
there any place that people can go to do the press? How do we give people an action?
Well, I think we published a paper. And anybody with a few functional brain cells should be able to take a patient and walk them through. The problem, it's not that they don't understand what we published. It's the system does not allow them to do that. They're locked into the standard of care, which is like written in granite. And if a physician with a good intention to help his patients wants to do this, he might lose his license for practicing a procedure not sanctioned by the establishment.
Totally.
So we're up against so many firewalls on establishment. Okay, but where it's going to come from, it has to come from grassroots. It can't come from the top. They're the last people on the planet to embrace this because you got too many big research grants tied up in hunting mutations, cancer mutations, right? Screening cancer mutations. Look at the mutations. My NIH grant, $15 million. I can't lose this. It's a waste of money and time doing that stuff. And you can look at the dead people piling up as the result of wasting all this millions and millions of dollars on things that are completely worthless, mostly completely worthless.
I would like to amplify what you just said because I think people need to understand that. The doctors are restricted from generally mentioning anything other than the big four. And please correct me if I'm wrong on this. Radiation, chemotherapy, surgery, and drugs, unless something else is approved, which is very hard to get approved. So we.
So what are you going to do?
But what
is anybody going to do about it?
Their hands are tied.
Yeah, that's right. And you need a healthcare professional. You know, if I got cancer, I know what to do. But I would also like to talk to one of my colleagues that I could consult with. I don't want to do it all by myself. Does anybody? It's like having a broken arm. I'm going to set it myself. You know, the you want some professional to help you.
The recurrence? To prevent recurrence, does one need to be eating in a ketosis manner forever?
I don't think so. Okay, the goal here is to now what happens, though, a lot of people who are successful and are getting MRI reports or PET scan reports or even blood work reports back saying, hey, we don't see any signs of cancer. They seem to adapt to a lifestyle that they're changed. They don't do the same risky kinds of things they did before their diagnosis. Not to say that they go right back to, you know, drinking 15 beers a day and pounding whiskey and smoking cigarettes and all this stuff. Most people, after they've been getting the diagnosis and see what it took out of them. This is another thing. This metabolic therapy requires a considerable input on the part of the patient. No longer does the patient have to sit there as some mannequin and get nuked. You know, this patient has to now take part in their own management. They have to know they have to remain compliant. Patient compliance is essential. It's essential for any kind of medication, anything you give a patient. But a lot of these poor people that can't afford the high-priced chemo become non-compliant because they're going broke. And that's another despicable thing. Financial toxicity is a new form of toxic thing for these cancer drugs. This CAR-T immunotherapy, this is like a Rube Goldberg. You know what Rube Goldberg is? It's a very complicated way to do something simple.
Yeah.
Right? They're taking the cells out of the patient. They're engineering them over here in California, sending them back to Boston. All you have to do is take away glucose and glutamine. What's wrong with these people? They don't know the biology of the problem. It's unbelievable. I have to deal with this every day. Can you believe this?
I personally love fasting, 8 hours of eating, 16 hours.
Well, now you got to go more.
Even intermittent fasting. Yeah,
try 3 or 4 days and see what it's like.
That would be great.
You start looking at your pet differently.
So my question is, bad dog. Cachexia, right? Cachexia and fasting. How do those go together?
Yeah. Well, cachexia is the part of the tumor signaling the muscles to release amino acids into the bloodstream so they can grow. So the tumor is dissolved eating your body, okay? Yeah. So what's driving the tumor? Glucose and glutamine. So if you do a ketogenic diet metabolic therapy, you'll starve the tumor of that and stop the cachexia. Of course, it's a downward slope that you're losing weight from the cachexia. And then, of course, you go down a little bit more as you're fasting. But then you get the turn, mm-hmm. and you come back up again. And now you're because you killed the tumor off. And then your body restores itself.
So then is it possible to say if somebody is not going to one of those clinics and they don't have regulated glutamine control, if they go on a very strong ketogenic protocol,
yeah,
that they're actually
going
to be supporting themselves in their own environment?
Yeah, I'm shocked about how people do so much better on these ketogenic diet cancer patients than the mouse ever did. So the mouse is just like, you know, he does well, but he doesn't do like humans. Humans seem to do much, much better. But I think if we took the glute, they're not hit the glutamine. If you hit glucose and glutamine, the tumor cells just can't survive. They burn other metabolites, but they're all gone. They go so quick. And then the tumor is like, you know, cells, they don't have access. So you gotta look at it that way.
Dr. Seafrey, has this not been extraordinary? My gosh. I think that's a standing ovation.
Yeah, thank you.
Right? I'm going to close the program.
Okay.
I am Adria Breyer, a member of the Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum. We thank Dr. Seafried for his comments here today. We should have a podcast on our website probably within a week. Share it liberally. We have extraordinary speakers here, and we have extraordinary podcasts that are available to the public. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating more than 115 years of enlightened discussion is almost adjourned. Don't forget, you've got the discount coupon flyer out there. And because I don't have the gavel, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.